What's up, Jake?
Hey, Giannis, how are you?
Good.
Awesome. Well, welcome to another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bow Hunting. I'm your host, Jake Kunkin, and today I have quite a special guest, a TV producer, a podcast producer, a TV host, a hunter, a fisherman, and Meat Eater's very own Giannis Patelis. Giannis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I reached out to you because I had gotten wind through just listening to the Meat Eater podcast and following you that you had been a guide in Colorado prior to joining up with Meat Eater. And I figured who better to talk to than guides in Colorado. They seem to have a lot of the knowledge and plenty of opinions on how things should be run as well. Before we get into where you are currently, I'm curious your hunting history. I was just telling you before we got started, I'm an adult onset hunter, but I remember seeing an episode of Meat Eater in Alaska with your father. Is he the one who introduced you to hunting?
Yep. By all means. I didn't get any small game, preschool. We went straight to deer. And so I think I did a couple, 3 years maybe without a gun in Michigan and Wisconsin. And then as soon as I was old enough to have a license in both those states, I started gun hunting for white-tailed deer. And then shortly thereafter, certainly by the time I know that when I had a car, I had a bow in the back. So at least by 16, I was bow hunting and going and sitting in a tree for white-tailed deer too. So yeah, that's where the beginning was.
Is this in your home state or were you guys traveling to go do these trips?
Yeah, I grew up in Michigan and then we travel over to Wisconsin.
Nice. It's interesting what a pocket of hunting Michigan is. It seems like there's a lot of interest that gets generated out of there. There's a where I hunt, where I got that bull elk I was showing you. There's this group of guys we call the Michigan guys, and they're always there and they're always killing it every year. They know the spot like the back of their hand. And man, something about people from Michigan have that knack, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird because there's definitely a lot of people leave Michigan too, for better hunting and fishing. But whatever it is about Michigan, it definitely. It supports it when you're young and what's the word I'm looking for? Not prosper, but tongue-tied here.
Yeah, stokes the flames a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a lot of people that go from Michigan out west or even skip going out west and go straight up to Alaska and go to those places where there's just a little bit more opportunity,
Yeah. I'm curious, as you were getting into hunting, was Western hunting an idea in your head or was it, we sit in tree stands, we go for whitetails, not a thought that crossed your mind really?
No. And honestly, I moved out west without any thoughts of ever hunting out west. I was in a phase of life where, whether it was chasing girls or partying, a lot of skiing and snowboarding, just young, I moved out west when I was 19. So,
oh, wow.
That really wasn't on my mind, but I think within a couple of years, I got interested in the fly fishing, and then my dad decided to do an elk hunt in the area, and that got me into the elk hunting. And actually, we rented a cabin from an outfitter and did a DIY hunt, and that outfitter then hired me on, and that's how I got my start in guiding.
Really? So was that all in Colorado?
Yeah.
Wow. So were you kind of, I don't like mean to say this in a negative way, somewhat rudderless and willing to take on an opportunity to elk guide? I mean, that's like a huge, sure, I'll pack up my life and come be in the mountains and clean the horses and tend the tents and do all the things.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was just always available for an adventure. And certainly it seemed lucrative in a way. And then, when someone tells you, yeah, you can hang out in the woods and, do these things and make money and you don't have to be a bartender or a waiter. I just jumped at the opportunity. But yes, I mean, that's a good way to put it, rudderless. My general flow of life has always been just go through the door that opens in front of me, as opposed to sort of having that door as a goal. And so, yeah, the opportunity came about and I decided to check it out. Here we are.
That's really cool. Did that immediately resonate with you? Because I know becoming a guide is a multi-step process, right? You got to be the grunt guy for a couple of years, and then you can start getting your license and taking on clients, maybe start your own business. What was your trajectory through guiding?
You know, it can be a multi-step process. I think it depends on how badly the outfitter needs guides. Because if he's got a bunch of clients and not enough guides, then like happened to me, I think the first couple of weeks I spent staining this cabin. It was actually the same cabin that we had rented the year before. And then, you know, and just doing chores and some, you know, very basic handiwork around the camp. And then mornings and evenings, I'd be out cruising around looking for elk and trying to learn the country. But I think I was... It must have only been 2 weeks because I think our muzzleloader season, I was told that I was going to be taking out a client, which I personally didn't think I was ready for. But again, I think the outfitter needed, you know, that warm body to walk somebody into the woods. And I think that it probably went on at least through that whole season, muzzleloader season and the following rifle seasons, where I was guiding people that probably had more elk hunting experience than I did.
Wow.
But again, it's just circumstances, you know.
Sure.
If you go and try to work for, you know, an outfit that has all guides that have worked there for 20 years and nobody wants to leave, sure. You're probably going to work your way up
for a few years.
But, you know, a lot of guiding too, you can be the best hunter in the world, but if you're not a friendly personality that can get along with people and not butt heads, guiding is going to be a tough gig for you. And I think the outfitter probably saw that I had an easy go of chatting with people and, you know, being buddies with everybody. And that probably helped me along too.
Yeah. I mean, as a guide, you got to be their champion. You got to be optimistic. You got to not show a certain level of frustration with certain behavior types or preparedness or readiness or things of that nature. I'm certain that you learning was like exponential at that point. I mean, for me, every like 3 days of hunting feels like a year or two of knowledge. So I'm sure you're getting that in a season now, like insane.
there's no better way to get good at hunting than to go guide for, you know, 90 straight days, roughly, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one, you've developed that toughness and your equipment, I'm sure, gets super dialed in, which I'm excited to talk about your Gear Talk podcast in a minute. But before we get to that, I'm really curious about, one, did you have some knowledge, you know, that first muzzleloader guiding trip, did you have some sit down with some senior guides and say, all right, where's my, what are we doing? A plan, B plan, C plan? How am I going to help this person find success? And then a part two to that question is, do you guide bow hunters and muzzleloaders and rifle hunters substantially differently than one another? Say it's the same hunt, same like almost week of the year, if you will. I know season dates are different, but two-part question there.
Yes, I did get a lot of help from more experienced senior guides. But honestly, some of the best advice I got was, you know, go into the woods and figure it out. It's just like if you put your dog on a lion track that's an hour old, that dog is going to run that lion track right to a tree within 5 minutes and you're going to catch a lion. Does that mean that you or your dog are good at lion hunting, or is the dog's good at following tracks? Not really. And so when someone says, oh yeah, go and sit in, you know, Elk Park, and they're going to come out of the northwest corner and you go there and do that, and you have success, you know, you didn't really make any of the decisions. You're not really going to gain much confidence. Sure, you can go back to that same spot and repeat it, but, you know, getting out there and doing it on my own was certainly the best thing I could have done. And just learning by trial and error. One of my favorite parts of guiding back then was certainly having a full day of hunting, and then after dinner, over beers in the bunkhouse, relaying my day to the senior guides and dissecting, you know, where I was, what we did, what happened, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, that obviously helps a lot. As far as guiding hunt,
different weapons.
You know, the different types of hunters are the ones that choose the different weapons.
Because like there's a range thing, right? You know, the rifle and a guy's got an effective range of 300, 400, maybe 500 yards. Is that than getting an elk into 30 yards or 40 yards for a guy?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's the whole tactics of it, I guess, because there's a lot of different facets that we could talk about of what is different when you're guiding these different hunters, because one, there's the tactics of it. So yeah, you're going to have to get the elk closer, and maybe you just set up, and you can still set up and wait and ambush like often you do with a rifle and hope they come down the trail that you've set up on. They come to the wallow that you set up on. But everybody at that camp really loved to call and to have that calling action. So we did a lot of that, and we'd obviously would call as much as we could right into rifle season. And if you could you know, call in a bull and second rifle, well, great, you know. But we definitely spent less time in the thicker woods and the smaller parks and more time in the, you know, bigger openings as the rifle seasons went on. And a lot of that too is just what the elk are doing, right? There's getting to be less and less feed in the timber. They're coming out into the openings more often to get to those, you know, where those, you know, there's more just grass growing on, you know, say some south facing hillsides, there's less snow. So a lot of it has to do with that. But I was going to say that you might guide the people a little bit differently too, just because I feel like most bow hunters, at least as clients, we're probably in a little bit better shape than the average rifle hunter. And I mean, again, this is averages. You know, we had marathon runners that came and did rifle hunts, and then we had overweight folks that came and did archery hunts. But for the most part, the archery hunter is going to be in a little bit better shape, so you can do more hiking, you hope. And they should have an expectation too that's a little bit more, you know, just understanding that success is not going to be 100% in camp, where a lot of rifle hunts, we would go 100% and it wasn't a big deal. But I think that we ran, you know, 25-30% for archery hunts, which is still double the success of, I think, the average, you know, public land guy, at least back then. So, but that's good because the hunters were just having a good time being in the woods. You know, I think they go into it like, sure, they want to be successful. But if you're a bow hunter, you know, there's going to be a lot of hunts, even if they're 5-day hunts, where you're going to come home without an animal, because, you know, it just happens as a bow hunter. You just, you know, it all depends on what kinds of parameters you set on yourself. You know, are you going to kill any bull? Do you have a certain type of bull that you're going for, or any elk for that matter? So yeah, success can depend upon that too. Cause some people, the guys or gals that hunt 400 inch bulls, you know, they could hunt for years and never release an arrow, and they're hunting
some folk.
Best place in the world. And they're letting elk walk by. Cause they're looking for something very specific.
Yeah. I appreciate that. So with that, you were talking about like getting back to guide camp and talking, trading kind of the stories, and it's one level additional to getting back to hunting camp and talking about what you saw that day, because you're also talking about your experience with your client and how they acted and the decisions they did or did not make. And, oh, I got to the top of the ridge and they didn't, and they couldn't get the shot opportunity. I'm curious, one, I'm sure that was like a huge lesson in one, human psychology, but also how to interact with different people. I'm sure there's people who would show up saying, I spent X thousands of dollars, where's my elk? Where other people are like, I'm excited to be in the woods. I got my cell phone off this week. This is going to be great. So with that, you talked a little bit about the best part of guiding. What was the worst part of being a guide? I'm curious if it was frustrating with someone's choices in the woods, or passing up on a good animal, or expecting, you know, white glove service from you the whole time, butcher my animal, carry it out for me.
You know, we were lucky. We never really had like a real, real bad a-hole type client over the course of 10 years that I worked up there. I mean, there were some guys that were a little more annoying than others. Honestly, man, there's not a lot of bad I could say about my experience as an elk hunting guide. It was all pretty positive, man. Just you know, it's hard work, but if you like that, then, you know, how they, whatever, however that saying goes, you know, if you do what you're passionate about, then you'll never work a day in your life. And I think being up in elk camp kind of felt like that, where I was always going like, man, I can't believe I'm getting paid.
Well, I'm certain you still have a little bit of that. I'm sure the responsibilities have changed, but to just be in hunting professionally and have, I don't know if escaped is the right word, but exited the guiding route, because there isn't a ton of professional hunting opportunity outside of guiding, or at least there hasn't been until last, you know, decade or so, with social media, with Netflix, with all of these items. I'm curious a little bit about that change from, I want to ask you all about guiding and the flat tops, and I probably will dive back into that a little bit. That's actually where I got my bull this year. So it made me think, I'm like, I wonder if Giannis has ever been back over this way. but stepping into Meat Eater, I'm curious how that introduction came. Was that through a guided hunt? Was that through a friend of a friend saying, so-and-so is looking for someone who is good with people and can talk to people? Was that through 0.0? Or I'm curious how you, that was a decade ago at this point, how you guys crossed paths.
It was exactly a decade ago. Steve's wife and I actually went to high school together.
Huh, small world.
Yeah, and we kept in touch loosely, but kept in touch after high school and even after the college years. And I guess I was the only hunter and fisherman that she knew. And so when she would sort of try to join in on the hunt and fishing conversation, she would drop my name. And Steve heard it enough from her. And then I think he actually did a hunt with a buddy of mine, Jay Scott. And Jay had mentioned my name. And then I think he saw a picture of me in like Western Hunter magazine. And all of it was enough that he just reached out to me. And I just happened to be living in Alaska at the time, and he had a Tok sheep tag, which is not far from Fairbanks, where I was living at the time, and he invited me along on the hunt, and I graciously accepted, and the rest is history.
That's wild. Did you meet Jay through Colorado? I know he guides a bit in Colorado.
So Jay was a fly fishing client of mine for years. So I used to guide him, you know, floating down the river. And, you know, within the first day or two, we got to talking about elk hunting. And he was like, oh, yeah, I liked elk hunting a little bit. And so then I went home and, you know, searched him up. And I was like, oh, yeah, that guy's killed multiple 400-inch bulls, you know. and so, yeah, we hit it off there. And so then he invited me to guide for him. And so I started working as a guide for him in Arizona and a little bit down in Mexico.
Man, how cool. That's such a thrilling lifestyle. I mean, tough to like feel grounded at points, I'm sure, you know, spending so many days abroad or away.
Well, it's tough to make ends meet, man, because you don't know what, you don't exactly know how much money you're bringing in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tough to be predictable at that point. Now, with a little bit more security, as well as a bit more of like a team behind you, I'm curious how your role at Meat Eater has evolved. I thought you were initially like on the more of the production side of the episodes, and then you start to come on camera. Now you got Meat Eater Hunts and On the Hunt, as well as the Gear Talk podcast. I'm curious that transition from, I guess, behind the lens to in front of it, how that felt. Was that just an opportunity that presented itself, like you mentioned earlier, versus I'd like to get more publicly facing? I don't know if that was a mission of yours.
It was not. It still really isn't. like the first day I hung out with Steve and we were heading down to that sheep hunt, he sort of in some way offered me at least the opportunity or that he would have the ability to help me have my own hunting TV show. And I like, at that moment, kindly declined and just said it really wasn't my thing.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously they hired me on, and you know, I as far as production goes, in the field production, I've worked every position available. I never became an editor, you know, I never really worked in post, although I worked with the editors to make the program. But I think that just through being a guest on Steve's Meat Eater show, people started to get, you know, used to seeing me. Certainly being the co-host of the Meat Eater podcast for a lot of years, people started becoming familiar with me. And so really the company felt like it was a natural progression for me to get more in front of the camera. And so that's how I started doing my own own shows, and then, you know, our own podcast, so on and so forth. So yeah, not really looking for any sort of fame, fortune, popularity. Looking to, you know, I do what's best for Meat Eater because they do what's best for me. And, you know, it's a great job to have. And I'm sure that my position will evolve again into something else. And it's fun to keep working on new stuff, new projects. You know, I love doing the writing thing and helping out on the writing, the book projects, but unfortunately it's with everything else, it's kind of the last thing I get involved in these days.
Yeah. It's fascinating how Meat Eater has evolved over the years, because I do think that it is a, like, the premier source for introducing humans to hunting, not necessarily humans that want to hunt, but just humans to hunting. If I have friends that are curious about it, besides my talking points of the North American model of wildlife conservation and other things that I really am proud of, I often point them to your guys' content. One, 0.0 is amazing. Like, they're just really good quality filmmakers. And so that, along with Steve's narrative and the cinematography, it's just like beautiful to watch. Actually, a funny side note, the day I killed my first whitetail buck in New York, I saw the premiere of Stars in the Sky in New York City. And I will watch that movie like once a year at this point. It's just like calming. It's great. but it is really interesting because I think that it's necessary, right? Hunting has been, outside of the people who know what it is, just Elmer Fudd for the most part, or like beer drinking dudes who are being loud type of redneck folk. And to paint it in a good light is not only valuable, but like tremendously important. It seems to be one of the few things that, I don't know if it's fully avoided politicization, if that's the right word, but it is something like, people love wildlife, people love public spaces, and it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. So for you guys to be such a great public facing entity, one, just thank you on behalf of hunting people. But two, that must feel, I wonder, does it feel like a real contribution? You must get people like me and other people reaching out to you guys all the time. Does it feel tangible that you're making an impact in the hunting community?
It does not. I mean, I know that we do, but it's funny that it's a good question, because I do struggle with it just in general, as, you know, as a person that's, you know, sort of in the prime of their life and working. You know, I sort of feel like, I don't want to say I've not made it, but I live a comfortable life, right? Mm-hmm. I've got insurance, I've got a house, my kids are fed and clothed. You know, life is good, but I often wonder and ask myself, like, you know, am I doing enough to just be for like a general positive help to the community? It doesn't even have to be the hunting community. Mm-hmm. And, because again, we do, it doesn't take me long. I can go into my DMs on Instagram and start reading through, and, you know, every whatever 20, 30th one, after some questions and some other goofy stuff, there's somebody that has a story of like, man, I didn't hunt, then I got into it and I found you guys and it's been life changing. So we hear that a lot, and why that's not tangible, I don't know. Why that's not enough, I don't know. So I'm always glad to hear it, and the more the better. That feedback is awesome. I don't know, maybe it's because we're in it, and maybe it's gonna have to be when we're 10 years past it to look back, you know. It's sort of the media. I was joking with the crew the other day, we were filming some duck and goose hunting, and you know, we have a great time filming. The crew is, not only do they film, but, you know, when they're done filming, they help set up decoys. They help tear down decoys, whatever it is. And it's a real fun team effort. And I was telling them, I'm like, man, there's going to be a day where we look back at this and say, those were the meat eater days. And boy, mm-hmm. was that fun, you know, and that was great. And so maybe the same thing goes for that sort of, you know, the tangibility of mm-hmm. it. Maybe it will be felt more, you know, later when we're removed from being in it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have been fascinated with hunting for about 10 years, although I've only been hunting for about 5. And I've started to go to TAC events, the ones in Colorado. I went to one in Utah last year. And one thing that's really given me a lot of joy is, one, not only how many people are there and how much fun they're having, but how many people like me I meet there. And, you know, I am the same guy who's crowding up the trailhead and adding to the orange army. But at the same time, it's really cool to meet a guy who's like, you were some dude sitting in some city and got interested in hunting and bought the equipment and moved out here. And we're standing on this mountain together trying to actually, I don't know, fulfill this thing, do this thing. It's almost like I can relate to your entry into guiding with my entry into hunting of like, this feels right. It feels like the right thing to be participating in. I'm not saying I am the highest ethical, best human being on the planet. But what I'm saying is that I feel like I'm contributing to something positive as well as to something that has the weight of history behind us, right? We all got here. I was explaining to a buddy of mine the other day that we are in the like most plush period of hunting in the history of humankind, right? We have all this equipment, all this luxury, all this mapping and communication. We go sleep back at the rooftop tent at the truck with the heater on or whatever we want. And it's just such an interesting place to be in life where hunting isn't necessary, but I feel like for you, for me, it is necessary, right? It's a piece of your existence. So I just kind of say that to reiterate, you do make an impact and it is positive. And there's other people. You're very welcome. There's other people out there I follow who may or may not make an impact, have a following, and I don't think they're necessarily the best spokesperson for the cause, if you will, whether it's whatever they're putting on their social media or what have you. And this is an argument that the hunting community will just have forever. And I'm curious how you feel about maybe being the finger pointed at as you're creating more hunters, you're clogging up the trailhead. My hunting spot used to be a gem secret honey hole, and now I see 20 guys back there, versus hunting can only be conserved, right? You can't build an apartment complex and be like, oh, in 30 years, we'll start hunting whitetails there again and grow trees. Like, it's there, it's concrete, it's established. So I'm curious how you feel about influencing more people to get interested in these things and then the potential quote unquote detriment to your hunting experience. And I don't know if that's different state to state or if it's all a net positive.
Yeah. Does it stink to have, you know, a loaded up unit or loaded up trailheads, a bunch of hunters? Sure. Like there's no doubt, but I do think that in the end, and again, 10 years removed from this, will hopefully my hope is that we'll look back and say that it was an overall benefit, you know, mm-hmm. for wildlife, for conservation, for, you know, just the future of hunting. I think if we don't have new people getting into it, there's plenty that anti side will grow in numbers, and it needs to be balanced. And that middle ground that we always talk about, or the middle group of people, they need to know plenty of hunters that are doing it right. So even if they never hunt, at least they're pro hunting. Mm-hmm. If we want to keep this thing going. So, no, I don't feel bad about it. You know, if there's a few extra hunters here and there, somehow the numbers are still saying that it's technically not happening. That mm-hmm. there's, you know, more and more hunters. I don't know. Maybe when the next big census comes out, we'll know differently, but, no, I'm happy about it, man, that it's if it becomes popular again and just overall supported by the general American public by the time we're done doing our thing, I'll consider that a major win.
I like that. And I'm with you there. A big part of why I do this, why I'm a part of the CBA, is because I want the narrative to, I want to not necessarily control the narrative, but I want people to understand my version of the narrative of the good that comes from this, the necessity of having people that care about these things out in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, my folks are from Long Island and New York, and that's quite a big metropolis area where hunting and gun ownership is just not a popular thing or a known thing. And watching them watching me enter this with intention, following people like you guys, and, you know, going from I don't have ethics established to the people I watch have good ethics, or at least appear to have good ethics, and it influences my behavior. I love that. I don't know if it's Aldo Leopold, but, you know, it's doing the right thing even when the wrong thing is legal and no one is watching. That little litmus test to how do you act in the world.
Yeah.
I'm curious a little bit about how you plan your season, your hunting, both personally, whether it's something you're doing off camera, or all of the logistics that get it to all the equipment, all the people. How do you have not only Steve, but you and Mark and all these people? You guys have 30, 40 hunts a year. A lot of them are being captured. There's spear fishing. I'm a huge spear fisherman, which I'd like to see underwater in some of these episodes, Yannis.
For me?
Yeah.
You and I did the first spear fishing episode together.
I remember.
But, you know... Montana is not a great place to live to be a spear fisherman. You know?
Neither is Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. So sure, there's some bodies of water that you can go do it in, and Steve has, and you can certainly practice in you know, swimming pools, but you still got to travel, you know, to go do it. And I just feel like I have, I'd rather go run with my hound in the mountains than be sitting in a pool holding my breath just because I'm going to go on one or two spear fishing trips. And listen, it's a great activity. I absolutely love it, but it just doesn't make sense to me, you know, living where I do and the cost of it that I would have to, you know, travel and spend that money. I'm gone in a way enough as it is, you know, and maybe if I had more disposable income, you know, it would totally be a plausible sure. thing. But, you know, I don't think I have 30 hunts. That seems like a lot.
Not you personally, but the entire like organization.
Oh, sure. Oh yeah. Well, we're way over that, I'm sure. I mean, I produce 6 episodes of my show. And then other than that, I try to hunt and fish. I mean, it's mostly hunting for me these days, but as much as I possibly can. And now that my girls are getting older, bigger, they're definitely easier to bring along, especially on some of these, you know, things that could turn into a little bit more of an adventure, like a day looking for mountain lion tracks and chasing a lion. But they're hikers now, you know, like they can go a lot farther than, you know, plenty of other, you know, grown adults, you know, in certain conditions. So, yeah, I mean, I know that I can tell you, like, I'm definitely always almost 6 months out. Like, I can tell you that my turkey season is pretty much planned out along with some bear hunt worked into there. So just staying ahead, you know, is big. And all of that is because it's not just for work, but it's you're just scheduling life in general, you know, and what you're going to do with the family and what you got to get done for work. And so on and so forth. So, just staying ahead, you know, it's better for me now because I get to pick, you know, the hunts I'm going to go on and really get to do the stuff that I'm more passionate about than say going and producing a show that Steve might be more interested in something that I'm not.
Right.
So I'm a little bit more focused. But it still is when you're hunting and it's like, it's such a, you know, not only a first world, first class, like rare dude that gets to hunt all the time, kind of a problem. But, and the variety, I guess, of what we hunt is the problem that you go from one hunt and you're not really anticipating or preparing for the next hunt. So let's just use the spring for example. I'll be just hammering on the turkeys, but I got a bear hunt coming up, and then, you know, I need to have a dialed in rifle. I need to have dialed in backpacking equipment. All that stuff's got to be ready to go so I can make the most out of the 5 days or whatever I have for my bear hunt. Yeah, it just, that gets tough, because you're unpacking from one, packing for another, and you just got to make sure that you're on top of your gear so that you don't forget stuff. Because there's nothing worse than, you know, owning all the best gear and then forgetting it at home, mm-hmm. and not using it and not having it for your hunt, you know?
Yeah. So I want to drill into that a little bit, because I find, you know, my lifestyle out here in Colorado always coming and going. And sometimes it's going from hiking to snowboarding to hunting to scouting to this and that. I'm curious, is there anything specifically you do, like an Excel spreadsheet with your gear on it, or a checklist, or that 6 month planning? Hey, I do this on Go Hunt and this on OnX, and then I revisit that the week before the hunt just to refresh all the information. I want to kind of get some of the details, the granular level of it.
Sure. I've got very basic lists for, say, you know, any kind of backpack hunt, any kind of, you know, more of a car camping hunt, or, you know, that kind of covers the basics. And then what I'll do is I'll have sub lists, and these just all live in my notes folder in my phone, mm-hmm. but I'll have sub lists that are like, hey, for bear hunting, make sure you always bring something to read, because you're going to have a bunch of downtime, and mm-hmm. It's great, you know, and whatever, maybe an umbrella or whatever it might be that's pretty specific to that hunt. Cause so much of I don't need to write down that I need to bring four pairs of socks on every time I go on a hunt. But it's those little kind of things that can make a huge difference. Those little details where you're like, man, so glad that I remembered to bring my giant safety pin for catching squirrels to my belt on this squirrel hunt, you know, cause otherwise you're putting a bunch of those bloody, you know, squirrels in your backpack, making a mess. And it's so nice to have a way to carry them, you know, on the outside. So yeah, little stuff like that. I'll just kind of keep like a little highlight gear list for each specific thing, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like anything, you know, getting packed ahead of time and not doing the night before, that's going to go a long ways, you know?
Do you have multiple sets of gear so that if you have a back-to-back hunt, you can not have to reuse everything, or some stuff has to cross over?
I mean, I certainly have, you know, plenty of gear. You know, you could probably outfit five of me at once around here. But a lot of it is like, I'll have a set of, you know, whatever, first light gear in a camouflage, so that if I'm going on a hunt where camouflage is needed, if it's an archery hunt or a turkey hunt, then, you know, that's the gear I'm going to use. But if I'm going just general, you know, rifle hunting, squirrel hunting, whatever, then I'm usually in solids. And so I'll have that. So there is a couple sets, but it's not really for that reason, because so I can just dump one and grab the other. It's more just because I prefer to, you know, wear solids if I don't need to have camo on.
Yeah.
I
was hoping it gets easier. It sounds like it doesn't get easier to be organized or to put up with the constant coming and going of items and things. I take the front seat out of my truck in mid-August because it makes hunting easier for the next 3 months. But my girlfriend is acting like I'm an Uber driver because she's in the back seat while I'm driving around Denver.
That's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, I think this general organization goes a long ways, right? Because then at least everything's in front of you in some way, and you can look at it all and remember to bring that extra pair of, you know, down mittens, because you're going to be, it's going to be a cold weather glassing type hunt, and that's going to be a huge extra piece to have. Where if it's not organized and it's just, you know, in piles or duffel bags full of gear, you're probably just going to keep going back to that one set, and you're going to just forget mm-hmm. had those down mittens buried somewhere in that duffel bag. So I do like to have a very tidy, and I'm lucky because our new house has a barn, and I've got basically space in the barn where I could organize my gear very, very well, you know, labeled, you know, open shelving, and you can look around there and just really kind of, as you're just looking, make sure that you don't need anything out of that box. You do need something out of that box, you know, and just kind of go down.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Me and my lady are looking at
it. When you come home from a hunt, you got to put the time in of just cleaning the duffel out nicely, cleaning everything, folding everything, put it back in its spot, and, you know, making sure you're ready to go for next time.
I think that's big. And I think that how you are with your gear, reflects how you are as a hunter, as a person, like both at home, clean, organized, up to date, greased or whatever. And then in the field too, are the things going back to the same pockets? Are you using the same methodology? It helps me not lose stuff. And it also helps me be more efficient, right? If I'm trying to get somewhere and the sun is setting, I don't want to spend 10 minutes looking for my inReach. It's always in this pocket or something like that. Mm-hmm. I want to be respectful of your time here. I have a few kind of random questions I want to throw your way as well. Going to your preferences with hunting, let's say, I don't want to say money isn't an issue, like not spending 80 grand on a tag, but let's put that on the side burner. Being on camera, none of that is an issue. You get to go with by yourself or your favorite person in the world. What hunt, weapon, and animal would be like, man, I would want to do that?
Oh, I'd probably go on some kind of a sheep hunt. And again, if money wasn't an issue and time wasn't an issue and I could stay out up there for 2 weeks, I definitely would bring the bow. And I would, yeah, I'd probably do it with, you know, a good friend or two. And again, sheep hunting, you're probably going to need a guide. So you got to work at that into the equation, but certainly that. And the reason being, and this is why I love the hound hunting so much now, is that it's coming down to me that what's important in these hunts is the adventure. Like if I just go on a hunt and it just, everything goes as planned and it's just all hunky dory and there's no type two fun that was had, meaning fun that wasn't so fun in the moment, but it's fun to talk about later. It's just like, if it's all smooth sailing, it's pretty boring in the end, you know? And even if you kill I didn't kill a big giant caribou on this last hunt I did in August. Didn't kill a caribou at all. It actually was a pretty smooth hunt. And that's what kind of got me on this thought process. I was talking to the pilot about, man, like it was fun. It was great, but we just didn't have the challenge. Like I needed something a little bit more. And he was like, dude, it sounds like you just need to go sheep hunting. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, but yeah, that's why, because I feel like on a big mountain hunt like that, where you're living out of your backpack for, you know, a week, maybe 2 weeks, you are just about guaranteed solid adventure. And like good challenges. And if you bring your bow, it's going to be more challenging and you're going to have a lot of close encounters that, you know, don't pan out. Hopefully in the end they do. But yeah, that's probably my dream hunt right now.
I love that. Yeah. That's like a one day for me. I mean, I'm putting in for my Colorado sheep, so we'll see. I'm 33. I hope it happens when I'm still able-bodied. but I'm always curious what people's like preferences, there's something interesting. Like I got my first rifle kill this year and, I don't know. I'm still processing it, but I really love the involvement you have with a bow. With a rifle in hand, I partially feel like I am a person entering this wild space and doing something in this wild space. With a bow in my hand, I feel like I'm a part, a piece of this environment and trying to kind of, I don't know, tap into the rhythms of what's going on versus there's something that it can't see me. I can see it. Here's 10 minutes for us to set up. And I know not all rifle hunts are that way. There's some exciting rifle hunts, but the adventure part is what really resonates with me. And I'm curious, you mentioned your dog. I think his name is Mingus. Is that right?
That's right.
Was part of the dog getting, I want to expand my hunting information. How do you train a dog up? How do you train them to do certain things? Or I'm curious what the inspiration was.
You know, I had always had the idea in my head that at some point in life as an adult, you know, when time and money would allow it, I would love to have a hunting dog and I wanted to train it. No idea what kind, whatever. But the inspiration honestly was purely because my kids were really wanted to have a dog. And it just so happened that they got four blue tick puppies at this pound nearby. And my wife called me and said, "Hey, we're going down. They got four puppies. If you want to be a part of this conversation, you better meet us down there." And so, you know, I went down there and, you know, you're not going to leave the pound after the kids have played for 10 minutes inside of the kennel with the puppies. You're not leaving without a dog, you know?
Yeah.
And so again, it's kind of like the rest of my life. It's like, here was this opportunity. We now had a bona fide hound dog, and you know, you might as well train him up and hunt him. And so we do.
Is there a balance between it being a family dog and it listening to your commands and it being trained properly? Are there ways, "Hey family, we don't do this with Mingus because we don't want him to jump on people or run away," or whatever the... My girlfriend's father has a GSP that's like very specific language what you use with it, you know?
Mm. You know, I'm sure that this dog can be trained better. They all can be trained. he's a hound. So there's a lot of times where he's a little ambivalent to... One is just a family dog. He doesn't show the affection that, say, a lab does, you know? And he can be very aloof as to just like, "Hey, man, I'm just laying here in the dirt and I'm happy. And if you come home, I might lift up my tail and my head, but I might not even get up. Like, I'm just going to keep laying here because I'm comfortable." that's his attitude. But, you know, we follow basic rules. There's no people, food, feeding to that dog. Yeah, he's taught not to jump up on people. But he does a great job just chilling, and he's great with the kids. They can play vet with him all they want, and he doesn't seem to mind. Like I said, as long as he's sort of in a position on his side and just chilling, nothing seems to bother him. And, when we get out into the woods, you know, he's all work and he's ready to get the job done. So it's really been pretty easy.
Any recent moments you're proud of, hunting specific moments you're proud of, either with the dog or maybe without?
I mean, even just the other day we hunted, and just watching him, you know, we hunt sometimes alone, sometimes with other dogs. And I've had the great opportunity to hunt with, have great mentors, I guess. And hunt with a bunch of different dogs, and you can see what good dogs do and how good, and this is specifically for, you know, lion and other cat hunting, and see how those good dogs work. So to see him picking up some of those traits, or he maybe isn't picking them up, but he's developing them, and he's, you know, he's hunting hard. You know, just the other day we were hunting, and there were some dogs that were kind of giving up on the track and not continue to hunt, continue to look for the out track. And Mingus was kind of doing that for a minute. And I just kind of kept urging him along, and then whatever happened, and it clicked in his head where all of a sudden he was making, you know, 100-yard loop away from me and kind of had left the other dogs. So it's good to see him, you know, going solo, using his own head, and remembering like, okay, this is what we're out here to do, and this is what I need to do to make it happen. So that was a good thing. I mean, obviously anytime they have a successful chase and they run a track all the way to the terminus where there's a cat in a tree, that's great. But I think that the more I do it, the highlights really come when, you know, they work through some sort of challenge, you know, that's hard, you know, like, and that usually in hound hunting, that's going to happen when they lose a track in, because, you know, when they're running it on snow, it's a very easy track for them. That half the time they can just see it and they don't even have to be smelling it. They can just run the track. But when that track all of a sudden turns out onto a scree slope that's on a south facing hillside, that's maybe had, you know, a lot of wind on it, maybe the sun hit it the day before and melted all the snow off, and all of a sudden that track goes from hot in the snow, hot meaning full of scent, and it goes out onto these rocks, and it's been evaporated maybe by the snow that got melted off or whatever. And at that point, to see them get through that hurdle, or over the hurdle, I should say, that's what it's all about, you know? And when you see that, you're like, that's awesome. Cause like any, this is my, my buddy Jake talking the other day, he's like, you can put a Chihuahua on like a 4 hour old lion track in the snow and it's going to run that track to the tree.
Right.
That lion, you know, it doesn't have to be a hound dog, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, but it takes a dog that's been trained and that uses its brain to figure out the hard ones, you know, and that's cool when you get to see that.
Yeah. I was listening to Clay Newcomb talk on his podcast recently about one of his best hunting dogs recently passed, and he had two dogs. And when they were together, he was like, man, I got two great hunting dogs. And then when the one passed, the other one couldn't tree a hound or tree a cat for the life of it, or a coon or whatever he was going for. But it's cool for you to see Mingus have independent hunting thoughts about what is my objective here. And I'm going to go, I don't know, make these choices. That's got to be a ton of fun. I just have a couple more for you here and then I'll let you go. They're kind of random, but one is, have you, whether it was guiding or during Meat Eater or solo, had any like emergency situations or almost emergency situations in the backcountry, whether it's hitting SOS or someone rolled an ankle and just had to get out slow?
You know, luckily, no. I've certainly been turned around in the woods a couple of times, never lost enough to have to spend the night out.
Yeah.
Never really had any major injuries on our teams, whether it was guiding or filming shows. I'm trying to think like what the, I actually did tear in a meniscus on a hunt, but I really didn't know that I did it at the time. And, you know, kind of hobbled around the next day, but it got better. And I didn't even get it, you know, fixed or looked at for a couple of years down the line until it got to feeling much worse. But, yeah, I don't, you know, it's probably been a combination of making good, safe choices and a little bit of luck. But yeah, we never, you know, for all the little rocks we probably hopped off of into deadfall or uneven terrain. Yeah, I've been lucky, never really had that, like, all right, stop everything. This is our going to be our number one focus, you know, is taking care of this situation. So,
well, that's great. And I've felt as I go out on my adventures, especially as I go out solo, that there's a level of awareness that you really start to hone and develop where I can be looking at the horizon, but I know what's going to be underneath my foot as it lands on the ground and how much weight is on my shoulders, just moving with intention, really. One last one, and that will kind of lead us into, I want you to promote what you got going on right now, is we all like kind of start to develop our own systems in the backcountry, whether it's how we pack our weapon or how we do our cook kit or our kill kit or whatever. Being that you have this Gear Talk podcast, I'm curious if there's any parts of your kit that you're particularly proud of, where you're like, oh, I modified this one thing and it's the most useful part of my whatever. I always bring this one tool with me because I use it, you know, twice a hunt.
You know, I'm going to disappoint you on this one. I don't think I have anything like too tricky. You know, it's funny because all this information, it's really not new. Sure, there might be some new gear that sometimes is lighter or better or faster or more efficient, but you know, all of the rules that make you a better backpacker will make you a better backpack hunter. And you know, lightening the load is certainly a big one, right? Like if you can actually keep your camp on your back and hunt, it just makes you so mobile, and it increases your just ability to move through the landscape. If you have to set up a camp and go hunt and come back, you know, that extra coming back and forth from the critters to your camp or whatever, it adds time and adds, you know, burned up energy. So it takes a lot, I feel like. And sometimes you can't even do it. If it gets to be later seasons when you guys start carrying just more clothing just to stay warm and, you know, maybe a 0 degree bag to stay warm, et cetera, it just gets to be almost too much to actually carry on your back. But, you know, realizing really what you can live without and what you can't, simple things like drinking out of your pot that you cook in. Like, do you really need to have an actual mug with you to drink coffee out of?
It
might be nice, but I don't think you really need it, right? That's something I started doing a couple of years ago on my sheep hunt and just realized, yeah, this is great. I can just drink out of this. But just having multiple uses for one thing is a great way to cut down. And sorry, I keep dinging here.
No, I don't hear it on my end.
Oh, good. But yeah.
Nothing specific in the pack that you're like, man, I love this one thing. It's something, you know, a pillow you sleep with, a multi-tool.
Well, that's just the thing, man. Is this something like a pillow? Is it something that in the end, I'm going to be happier not carrying that pillow than having it for that? I can make a pillow out of my clothing that suits me just fine. And I do believe that it is important to be comfortable and to get a good night's rest, because if you're not doing that, it's going to be hard to perform and make good decisions when you're in the field hunting. And we all know that you might only get that one opportunity in a 5 or 7 day hunt. And so you better be fresh and rested so that you can make the most of it in that moment. But man, really, it's just my gear has become so pared down that there's just not much there, you know?
Yeah. So I guess I can ask a kind of part B is being sure. A part of Meat Eater with FHF and First Light and all and Phelps. Do you ever feel a little overwhelmed being asked to utilize new gear versus like, I like my thing. I don't want to change my whatever.
No, we're pretty honest with ourselves about that. And I say us, like the company, it's
yeah.
If that certain piece of gear is not working for you, then you're not by any means obligated to use it and talk about it and promote it. That stuff's got to come from the heart and be authentic, you know, if you're really going to sell people on it. So
that's good.
For instance, the FHF chest rig, I've tried it a bunch. I've used it fishing. I'm not a huge fly fisherman anymore. I used to be. It worked good for that. Clay loves it for coon hunting. I keep trying it for lion hunting. But in the end, I find that I don't need it there. It's easier for me to change layers if it's not there. And mm-hmm. So I've actually just taken everything out of it. I use my pockets instead for whatever I need while I'm hound hunting. And I just don't need it. So it's I don't feel overwhelmed. It's nice to have the option of a lot of great gear to choose from and figure out what you like, you know?
Sure, man. Well, I really appreciate you. I want to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know where they can find you on Instagram. You're Giannis_Patellis, and I'll put this in the show notes so people don't have to worry about spelling. But you also have this recently aired podcast with Jordan Budd. Maybe tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that. And then you said you filmed more episodes of, is it On the Hunt or Meat Eater Hunts? What are you guys calling
it? It's On the Hunt. I decided to change the name because Meteor Hunts was too close to the namesake.
Yeah, yeah.
Too many people just thought we were coming to film Meat Eater or asking where Steven Ranella was. And it just got to be, you know, a nuisance. And I was like, this show needs to have its own name, you know?
Yeah, 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 yeah. So, well, I think it's great, man.
Yeah, so thank you. Yeah, that was my friend and colleague Tracy came up with that title, and yeah, it works.
Awesome.
So yeah, we've got that. We've got we're actually editing right now. We did some Texas hogs and Texas nilgai last year. That's a hunt that's coming out. What else? I did a couple episodes in Latvia this past September.
Oh, cool.
Coming out. I did a lion hunt where we end up catching a bobcat with my buddy Jake. That'll be coming out. And a couple others. But yeah, the podcast, it's called Gear Talk with Jordan Budd. The name says it all. We pretty much talk hunting gear. We'll probably get into a little bit of fishing, really any kind of gear that we're into or we're using or we're messing with, we're going to end up talking about. It's every other week right now. But I'm guessing pretty soon, just because it's kind of only hard doing it every other week, because it's hard to stay current, because we'll record sure. and by the time an episode comes out, it might be a month later and we're talking about something that was, you know, current in October. Yep. Now it's December and people are like, yeah, I'm not that interested in that, whatever it might be. So,
right.
Yeah. Look for more of those coming out soon. But it's been fun. I love gear. I've been a gearhead forever. I love diving into it and just learning more about it, learning what's out there. It's, you know, and hopefully people gain some insights.
Yeah.
And, you know, for their gear purchases and gear use from it. But yeah, you can always hear me on most Meat Eater podcasts as well.
And Trivia. You do quite well.
Thanks.
More level-headed than some other people on there.
yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of my job is playing trivia. It's a hoot.
Well, man, really appreciate you coming on here. I'm not trying to shut you off. I just don't want to steal too much of your time here.
Sure. No. Thanks for having me on. Yeah. Check out what I got going on Instagram. If you are a Gear Talk listener, go to the Meteor website. And you can comment on each episode. We're trying to make it pretty interactive so that we can, you know, talk more about the things that the listeners want to hear about. And if they have specific questions, we can answer them that way. So if you go to the Meteor website, find our podcast page, and then click on a specific episode, there is a comment section there. And so you can comment, and then hopefully that'll help us, you know, build a better product for all the listeners.
That's great. And then for everybody else out there listening, themeateater.com now has every episode of like every show they've ever done available. So you got like hundreds of hours of hunts to watch whenever you're just looking for something to put on. For everybody else, join the CBA if you're thinking about it. $40 for a year. You get six issues of our magazine. All of these podcasts come to you for free, but just want to keep supporting the CBA and hunting. And man, Giannis, you are an awesome personality to have in the hunting world community. I thank you for what you're doing, and I thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, Jake. Have a good one.
You too, brother.